Hello, my name is Mike Diedrich, and this is the Veterans for Peace Daniel Ellsberg Chapter 92 radio show. It's broadcast on KODX 96.9. And with me today are Hwang Dae-hyun, who is a professor of
Nursing.
nursing in Tacoma.
Now at St. Martin's University in Olympia.
And then also Professor Christoph Gebel of the University of Washington History Department in the Southeast Asian section there. So I'll start off with an introduction myself. My name, as I said, Mike Diedrich. I was an Army interrogator linguist in Vietnam in 1968. And one of my jobs was interrogating prisoners of war for order of battle. And order of battle is basically nuts and bolts of military intelligence. That is, how large your unit was, where it was, what kind of weapons you had, what kind of leadership you had. So that's what I did for a year, including in Cholon and also in field trips out to the Highlands and First Infantry. So those reports that I did and passed them up the chain of command, order of battle, were looked at by intelligence analysts, of which I was trained as an analyst also, but that was not my primary job. I was an interrogator. So these reports from me and other order of battle interrogators in particular actually presented a fairly accurate in total the number and operational capability of the Southern forces, the resistance forces in South Vietnam, so-called NLF. Those reports, those intelligence analyst reports, were delayed, redacted, and misrepresented by Westmoreland and his staff because they reflected too accurately a larger number of soldiers that were capable of fighting the wars against us. And in particular, so they redacted those things and actually downgraded the numbers of the actual capabilities. Just before the Tet Offensive, Westmoreland said that, the famous quote, the light at the end of the tunnel. So that when the Tet Offensive happened and May Offensive happened and the almost every provincial and district capital in the south of the DMZ was attacked, people asked rhetorically, so where the hell did all these people come from? Well, they were there all the time. So the effect that this had on the war was that the American people were kept out of the truth of the war, that we were not winning the war. And Westmoreland lied, and Johnson lied, and the effect of it would have been a much shorter war. More likely would have been the government of South Vietnam would have been forced to accept some sort of representation by the NLF or some other communist entity. And the war would have been much shorter. By the 1968, there were some 30-some thousand American dead, went on to kill another almost 30,000 and perhaps 1 million more Vietnamese. So that's my sort of background to it. And it's something that Westmoreland was involved in a CBS lawsuit in which he was eventually dropped the suit because all of the assertions that he said were lies were in fact true. They had interviewed a whole bunch of former intelligence analysts who said that, this is the truth. The information was double entered, and that the American public was therefore lied to. I came across it. You might have made it. The Order of Battle Deception of the Vietnam War, 1965 to 1968, by Joseph E. Stinson, which is it is a master's thesis, master's PhD thesis, and it does a good job of. For 1970, there are some things that came out, of course, after that, but basically, she makes the point that they lied, the American public lied, and the war was allowed to be progressed until the final catastrophic failure of the war. So that's my sort of background to it. I mean, it's of my experience and the I mean, you can make what of that if you will, but that's sort of my introduction to the issue of why we failed to win the war, whatever that might have looked like, but why we lost the war. So, Han, do you want to go and make some remarks, or Christoph? Go ahead, are you muted? You're muted.
Forgot.
Yeah.
Well, my name is Hong Thi Yoheng, and I'm a registered nurse, an educator, and a researcher. But I'm speaking today just as a citizen, a witness of the war that the American people call the Vietnam War and its aftermath. I was 14 in 1975 when the artillery stopped. And I said that because the war didn't stop for us, for the Vietnamese people, especially for those who are overseas. It raged inside without the gunpowder. I am now 64, so I was young enough to not be directly involved in the war effort, but old enough to see, feel, and remember, and recall what happened, how it felt, and what came afterwards. And we're still living that today. So that's basically my background. Mike, do you want me to speak more about what the 50s means to me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I lived in Vietnam in 1975. I witnessed what was coming down the last few days of the Republic of Vietnam at the time. And I noticed right away, this is that I was 14, so old enough to know that this was a historic moment. So I recorded everything in here and said to myself, I am witnessing history. I need to remember these so that I can tell my children and their children later on. I left Vietnam in 1979 on a boat. I'm one of those boat people. I ended up in a refugee camp in Indonesia and resettled in the United States in 1980. So I spent nearly a year in a refugee camp before coming here to the United States. Every year since that I have been in the United States, every year when the month of April comes around, my friends, my people around me who are of Vietnamese descent would start remembering, reminiscing about why we're here, about the life that we had left. This year's a little bit different. We still do that. But this year, I see more of people not looking less at the past and mourning the loss of the life that we no longer have, that we were hoping to have in Vietnam. Instead, people celebrate the resilience of the Vietnamese people and look forward to a future where on how we can strengthen our community, preserve our culture, our language, and define our identity for for us in the generations to come. And so I'm seeing a shift. That is not to say that there aren't people who still look back and who still think of, who still lament the past, and who are still holding a lot of hurt. There's still a lot of hurt around, but less of that is being expressed during this time of commemoration here. And I can't speak to the entire United States or all the Vietnamese overseas, but only in my group of friends who are scattered around the globe, and also among the Vietnamese community here in Washington State. So I think I'll stop there so that Krista could think.
You also have some family in Vietnam, still in Vietnam. Do they talk about the end of the war?
Oh
And
yeah. Well, I just backtrack a little bit. I left by myself without my immediate family, but they joined me in 1991 and 1992. It took me 10, 11 years to apply for an immigrant visa for them to immigrate to the U.S. on family reunification. It's a legal immigration process that the administration is trying to reduce the number of. So my entire immediate family, my parents and my two brothers, are here living in the United States. But I have and relatives that are still in Vietnam, lots and lots and lots of them are still in Vietnam. So I do go and visit when I can.
But some of your family were on different sides of the war, is that right?
That's true. Not again, not my immediate family, but my dad was from the north. He was a refugee that fled south in 1954. His family was landowners and Catholics, and so they fled south on tips of people close to them who were with the revolution and said, "You guys better go. If you stay, things won't be good for you." So they left. Didn't like it, but they left. I have talked to my dad about his trip south, but so that's one part. He still had a lot of relatives in the north. That's one part, one side of my family. The other side of the family, my mom's side of her family, there were uncles and more distant relatives who fought against the French. They joined the Viet Minh, fought against the French, and then continue after the French left. And some of them went north in 1954. Some of them stay behind. To be honest, in 1975, at 14, first, I was glad that the war ended, because I didn't have to worry about when one of those rockets or gunfire that I heard at night would, when it, one of those would fall on my loved ones. But the other thing is that I had families from the other side that I heard about but never met, and I wanted to see them. I wanted to go back and visit my dad's homeland in the north, and I wanted to see my aunt who went north, and my uncle who was actually imprisoned in Gongshan, and then later was sent north. After the exchange, at the exchange in 1973 after the Paris Accord.
And for just mentioning, Khon Shan was the island and prison that the Republic of Vietnam kept. It was actually an old French prison that
Yeah, and just he, I was told I have a cousin, a person who married one of my cousins, who was a prison guard at Gongshan, and he told us that my uncle was a frequent resident of the tiger cage because he was a rebel rouser. Always tried to fight for the rights of the prisoners. So, and that's one part of reason he didn't get released home to my grandma. Grandma, after 1973, grandma would sit in front on the front porch, looking up the road, waited for her son to come home. And in order to do that too, she didn't the government. This is the Republic of Vietnam government require her to hold a plaque that said "Đã đảo Cộng sản," so down with the communists. My grandma wouldn't do it, so my aunt, who lived with grandma, held it, and I have a photo of that in front of their house. But Uncle didn't come home because he refused to step on the flag of the NLF at the time. He was told, again, this is from my cousin, that he was told to degrade the flag. Then he could get released home to his family. He had wife and children at home too. But he didn't, so he got sent to the north eventually.
Well, those remarks or stories coincide with what I heard from the interviews that I did with these Southern Voices, these eight NLF soldiers, and some of whom were imprisoned in Khon Shan Island, and they were Viet Dong, most of them, and were recalcitrant and supporters of the communist resolution, and they were not treated well at all. In fact, they were mostly lucky to get out of there alive.
My aunt didn't recognize her brother when she went to meet with him when she received the notice that he was released. She walked up and down that line, couldn't find her brother. And finally she asked, and somebody said, "Oh yeah, he was among the first one who was brought out." Turned out he was so emaciated. And his legs had been beaten so much that they were weak. He couldn't walk. And so he was carried by two people. And she couldn't. He was a big man, and she just looked right straight past him, didn't recognize her own brother.
No, it's my opinion. I don't have anything facts to prove this, but it's because of the communists when they finally occupied the South and found out that that prison, Khon Shan, and other prisoners, the way that the NLF and the other communist soldiers were treated, is the reason why there were the re-education camps were so harsh on the Arvin and other soldiers. I can't prove that, but I think that's probably had to be, it's human nature to be revengeful, and they certainly were.
I talked to a lot of people who were in the so-called re-education camp. Many of them would refuse to call it that. They just called it a prison.
Yeah.
We went to prison. That's true.
Yeah.
There were not so much beatings as there were not enough food,
Yeah.
not enough medicine, not enough of anything. And some of them, one of my classmates, whose dad died in the north, in a prison in the north. He said that his dad died of starvation because he ate something, some poisonous something, and died from food poisoning. But he only did that because he was starving. He
Yeah.
did, they didn't have enough food. And that is from what I have heard from people who actually had been in the camp.
If I think that was probably true, this retribution had some sort of an aspect of it, but also to for the communist government made went out of its way to actually degrade and not maintain the graveyards of many of the army soldiers. That has
And
changed a bit since then, but that was something that they used to humiliate.
I just want to stress another thing too, is not so much the physical beating, but it's the when these people were asked to report, they were told, and I would say I remember the call, they were told to pack for 10 days. They were gone longer than that. The family didn't know where they were gone. That was torture. That was torture for the prisoners and for the family. And that is a fact. It didn't need any physical violence to call it torture.
Yeah. Well, considering the abuse that communist soldiers suffered at the hand of the RVN, it's amazing that that's all that was happened to the so-called prisons and re-education camps. Well, Christoph, you were actually not really a camp, but you were during the course of the war, before the war, you were a volunteer in the refugee camps in Cambodia.
No, in fact, it was very refugee camp that Hien had passed through, albeit about half a year before I arrived. I was born and raised in West Germany. I was a conscientious objector to the draft in the Cold War, and in my alternative service became a paramedic, so an ambulance driver, an ambulance man. And after my service, I used that to land a job on a West German Red Cross hospital ship that was sent in 1979 to Indonesian waters to help with the influx of so-called Vietnamese boat people, refugees. And I arrived there in June 1980, and eventually stayed for 11 months. So I left in May 1981, and we mainly operated around Kuku camp in the Anambas Islands. That experience obviously changed my life because I did not go to med school, but instead decided to I wanted to study about Asia and Vietnam and China in particular. Did that in West Germany at first. And then had the opportunity to become one of the first Western students, in fact, allowed back into post-war reunified Vietnam. And I spent 1 year in Hanoi as a student at a time when there were no Americans in Vietnam. So I was one of the very first Western students. Some Australians, Japanese, Swedish, and I was the first West German one to be in Vietnam for a long time. I had also lived in Vietnamese refugee communities in British Columbia for a while. So I mean, through my work in the refugee camps, and then later on, but then also my year in reunified Vietnam, I really had that I really could understand both sides, so to say, of the equation, which later on, of course, has really informed the way I have been teaching and researching and writing about Vietnam, precisely because I have that kind of very unusual background on having worked with both anti-communist and then revolutionary in Vietnamese communities of that persuasion. I have a joint appointment at UW in the Jackson School of International Studies and in History as a Southeast Asian historian since 1998, so I'm about to retire. But I've had a long tenure at UW and have been teaching about Southeast Asia, in particular, of course, Vietnam and the wars there for more than a quarter century. And so naturally, of course, the 50th anniversary of the war was a major milestone. And I was in Vietnam in April. I didn't stay there on April 30, but I was there in the run-up to April 30 and saw the preparation work in Saigon, especially for the big military parades and all that. My own work, I was a grad student at Cornell. Ian and I actually met at Cornell. We've been longtime friends as fellow grad students, and I've been focused, like many Vietnam scholars of my generation, more on researching the revolutionary side of the war. And there's a concrete reason for that. I think the previous generation of scholarship on Vietnam was heavily influenced by people who were really, who were right in the middle of the Cold War. Much of the scholarship was either idealizing the Vietnamese Revolution or denigrating the Vietnamese Revolution. So it was very kind of extremes, ideologically motivated through Cold War sides. And I think my generation started out with the idea that we wanted to study Vietnam beyond the kind of constraints of Cold War ideological camps and just put it back on its feet, right? So really use it as a kind of scholarly research topic. And it was clear that at that point, Western understanding of the revolutionary state, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, was severely lacking, right? And so for those reasons, a lot of younger scholars of my generation, we were young once in the 1990s, concentrated quite a bit on revolutionary Vietnam, did critical work from culture to politics to society. And I myself have contributed to that. Recently, I think quite interesting and promising a new direction has emerged in scholarship, where the Republic of Vietnam, so what is usually referred to as South Vietnam, so the Southern Republic of Vietnam is now more the focus of scholarship. With a sense that it had been neglected. And I share that sentiment very much. But I think it is a generational shift, precisely because my generation felt that to understand the winning side that had been so misunderstood was the first order. And that doesn't mean that it is not important to understand also the losing state in Vietnam. I leave it at that right now, but I want to say, since the topic is 50-year anniversary of Vietnam, that I want to say, both as a scholar but also as kind of a private observer, that I still find it quite painful to see that the various camps of the Vietnam War 50 years later still remain pretty deeply entrenched in their own narratives, and that the and I'm talking about kind of public culture or you know the public out there, not necessarily scholarship, but in public, that you know the winning side, which is ruling Vietnam since 1975 as a unified country, the Communist Party of Vietnam is still portraying the war as a triumph of the Communist Party. It has a very hard time acknowledging the contributions of non-communist in the larger revolutionary alliance, particularly Southern revolutionaries that arguably sacrificed the most of all factions in the in that long war, and who had been kind of cast aside by the Communist Party after 1975. And it still continues, at least in some quarters, to denigrate the losing Republic of Vietnam and their supporters as kind of puppets and all that, even though that is slowly changing, and that gives me a little bit of hope. But you know, moving to the Vietnamese diaspora too here, I think particularly the older generation is still very much entrenched in their anti-communist narrative and in their identity as South Vietnam, quote unquote, that it was the victim of a northern communist invasion and was abandoned by the Americans. So there's a lot of kind of grievance narratives that again are not particularly interested in trying to reach out and understand what led to the catastrophe of 1975. And when I look at the kind of mainstream American narratives about the war 50 years later, I also find that the United States in general has a very hard time breaking out of the Cold War framing of the war as one between two separate countries. One is called North Vietnam, the other one is South Vietnam. You know, the United States intervening on behalf of South Vietnam to defend freedom and democracy. And these kind of Cold War propaganda frames that are historically simply wrong. And much more nuanced. This is how mainstream America seemingly is stuck still 50 years later. And I'm saying this because, you know, I grew up in West Germany right around the time, about 25 years after the end of the catastrophe of World War II, Nazi Germany's culpability in you know, bringing so much misery to other people and the Holocaust and all that. And around 1970, there was a real movement among particularly younger Germans to really face the past, confront the older generation about what had happened, and not to let people get away with being stuck in victimhood narratives. I think when I compare this to a German attempt to come to terms with past catastrophe, I'm a little bit saddened to see that 50 years later, both in mainstream America, in the Vietnamese American diaspora, and also in Vietnam, the camps are still pretty much entrenched, and very little effort is made to try to understand the other side, or a breakout of comfortable but historically inaccurate frames.
If I may add to that, Christoph, first of all, I really appreciate you bringing up how the NLF, the National Liberation Front, the Southern branch of the revolution, got sidelined. I do know firsthand. There were people who were doing that, and they suffered greatly because they had to go in hiding. Their families lived right there, and they went through great lengths to suffer for the revolution, and they really got sidelined in favor of the Southerners who went north and returned, and Northerners who were sent south to. I actually see that, and I maybe get into trouble for saying this, but I see that as a an internal colonization of the North,
Yes.
imposed on the former South. I really saw that, and it's happening. It was happening more strongly after the end of the war. It was very strong in the 90s when I was working in Vietnam, and it continues to a certain extent, less so now.
Right. Absolutely. I agree. And I mean, if you look at the big picture of the war, which is a very complex war, of course, it cannot be reduced to simply revolution or anti-colonialism or anti-imperialism or anti-communism. But it's a layer of decolonizing war or neo-colonial war. It's a layer of civil war, of course, among Vietnamese as well, and it's a conflict in the Cold War. So there are so many layers of the war. But if you really took the big picture of the war and the outcome of 1975, I would say that without the Southern NLF, the outcome of the war is impossible to imagine.
Agreed.
They were the fulcrum of everything that happened and that led to 1975. And they are the least understood, the least studied, and the least represented in all of the post-war narratives. And my colleague, who has unfortunately died a few years ago, Moving Lom at University of Maine, he used to say that there is actually a unspoken alliance between Washington DC, Saigon, and Hanoi to not talk about the NLF. And that is because for Washington, the NLF was, of course, they had to be de-Southernized, right? Because for in Washington's narratives, there was only one South Vietnam, and it was threatened by invasion from North Vietnam. And the fact that there was a Southern resistance of, extraordinary staying power was very inconvenient, right? So the Viet Cong was always an appendix of Hanoi, they're puppets of Ho Chi Minh and all of that, right? Now, Saigon, of course, the Republic of Vietnam, the anti-communist state, also had an interest in downplaying the NLF as simply VC, Viet Cong, right? Because they also threatened the narrative of Saigon representing all of South Vietnam, right? And then finally, Hanoi did not want to really acknowledge the NLF after 1975 because they stood in the way of the triumphalist narrative of we as the Vietnamese Communist Party did all of that, right? So the Communist Party took all the credit after 1975 and the NLF stood in the way. So this is really a very tragic outcome of 1975, that the one faction that was instrumental in making the outcome of 1975 possible is the least understood and the least heard.
And some of those actually got so disillusioned that later, when there was a chance, they left the country. The
Absolutely.
problem with them, with that, is that when they come here, if anybody knew about their background, then they're outcast too, overseas, and they're outcast in Vietnam. So they suffered the most during the
Yes.
war, and they suffered the most after the war. And so, and thank you, Mike, for the book that of the Southern voices that you have. At least there was a little bit of that to be
Yeah, well, thank you for
of
that.
their work is spoken.
It probably book now would not have happened had not been your extensive translation contributions. I appreciate that a lot, Heed. But yeah, that is a small, and it's one of the few items, not only sort of primary source materials, the interviews of these eight NLF soldiers, five of whom were actually Viet Dong, and they repeated in that book, narrated of their disillusionment and how badly they were treated, to the extent, and they're very much aware of the party's sort of sway over it, because when I went took the book back with the text, translated text, they said, "Well, I'm going to take that out. That's a little too strong." So they had that sort of. The other thing is that I want to make a comment about was that the American perception, and talking about the American political class, but also the American military, they never accept, with the except they never accepted the competence and the resourcefulness of the NLF. They like to portray them as just a sort of a as terrorists. They quit doing that after a while, but they for a long time they were called just terrorists, and that the American military does not like to admit, and it's reflected in the Army's official history of the war, that these people were much more competent than they were given credit. If you went and talked to a battalion commander, he would have a different story, because they knew just how competent these soldiers were. But the American military does not like to admit that, because it means that they failed to defeat a forces that were occupied. They'd had no navy, no air force, no heavy artillery, no armor, and they defeated them on the battlefield. They were actually, I've heard this remark too, and it's my personal opinion too, they were better soldiers. Not because the Americans didn't try, but they were just out of their depth. American soldiers fought bravely as well as they could, but they were not as good as soldiers as these NLF soldiers in particular. So that's one of the things the American, and it's sort of, and it's an arrogance reflecting to what the Americans took over from the French after they stupidly let the French back in after the Second World War to reclaim their colonies. Well, they said, well, the French have been there 100 years or so, and the French actually did some things that were, had some positive effects. But they said to the French, well, you've been there 100 years, we can do this better. And they didn't. And they failed because they were arrogant. They would not accept the sort of competence of the NLF. And that's the story of the war. They did not accept. You have to, there's some books written about the Battle of Atbash, which was an earlier war, or earlier battle. And during that battle, actually, a small relative, small Viet Cong, so-called Viet Cong NLF battalion, defeated a much larger ARVN force, a mechanized armor force, of which a guy and a famous advisor was a it killed shot down five helicopters and killed a couple of American advisors, and killed 60 or 70 ARVNs. They did not succeed in defeating that small battalion of NLF, who retreated with their dead from the battlefield. So I mean, we consistently failed to give the Vietnamese the credit which they should have due. Now I'm just going to Thomas L. Ahern, which I quote in my book, the Southern Voices. You're familiar with it, but for the sake of this recording, I'll read it. It is clear now, although then obscured by American ideological perceptions, transitory government GVN successes, and the communists' own weaknesses, that the Viet Cong succeeded by exploiting the social and economic legacy of the colonial period. Only a collapse of communist will to win could have altered the outcome, and that will never faltered. The North Vietnamese tanks rolling into Saigon on April 30th, 1975, sealed a victory that the Southern insurgents had won more than a decade before. And the
Well, and if I may jump in, but that also is, of course, at the heart of why the standard narrative of North Vietnam versus South Vietnam and a northern communist invasion of a unified South Vietnam is so simplistic and so wrong, because it was, of course, a civil war and particularly intense in the southern half of Vietnam, south of the 17th parallel, where you had at least three very distinct factions, right? A much more urban, upper middle class milieu of anti-communists that were associated with the Republican government, Republic of Vietnam government in Saigon. But you also had this very long-standing, oftentimes generation-long, network of revolutionary and anti-colonial fighters that eventually re-emerged in the National Liberation Front by 1960, that never went away. I mean, I think that your quote is very apt by Thomas Ahearn, right? And then also a third faction, oftentimes also urban, but so-called neutralists or third force, people that oftentimes associate with the organized Buddhist church, that were neither a communist nor supporters of the Republic of Vietnam. And in this environment, it was a southern society in particular that was riven with factionalism, that it is almost ahistorical to talk about one South Vietnam. There were actually many South Vietnams or several South Vietnams to talk about. But the fact is, of course, for any Vietnamese who grew up in that era, Vietnam continued to be one country, right? So this is at the heart of the fallacy of Western discourses about the Vietnam War, is that we are pretending that the Geneva Accords in 1955 divided Vietnam into two separate countries, that the 17th parallel was a political border, and it was not. It was simply a contingent and temporary military dividing line for ceasefire purposes. But the two Vietnamese states, rival states that had emerged by that time, one based in Hanoi and one in Saigon, both claimed all of Vietnam for themselves exclusively, right? And they never accepted the 17th parallel as a political border between two discrete separate countries, North Vietnam and South Vietnam. That is in exclusively a Western Cold War propaganda frame that we have never transcended in our own country.
I want to put emphasis on that too, with a personal anecdote. I was a schoolgirl during the war. I was born in 1961. I went to school all through the war. In geography class, in history class, we had one Vietnam. That was the when we drew the map of Vietnam, it's all the whole thing from north to south. It's never that we never drew just the southern part. So I'll start from Lao Cai all the way down to Cà Mau, the S curve. So and history is also just one Vietnam. We never were taught that we were just the country of South Vietnam. So even in the heart of the people, we were just one people,
Yes,
one
I
people.
think the saying is một nước hai hai quốc gia and ba chính phủ, right? So one country, two states, and three governments.
Three governments, right. No, that didn't filter down to a schoolgirl my age. But we were, it never occurred to us that there was a North Vietnam and a South Vietnam. The northern people and the south, there were regionalism, but not two na not two countries or two peoples. We were one people.
And I've long argued, and that's how I teach it too. I try to teach my Vietnam War class actually to from all perspectives. I'd really try to honor the various perspectives of the combatants and factions. And I'm completely convinced, and I'm teaching that way, that had Saigon, the Republic of Vietnam, what is called South Vietnam in Western discourses, had they had the opportunity to go north and quote unquote liberate the north from communist rule, as they would have called it, they would have done it. And so they were very open about it, right? There was public propaganda posters of reclaiming the north. And that made Americans actually during the war very uncomfortable because the United States, of course, was also intervening in southern Vietnam under the pretext that it was defending a separate country, South Vietnam, right? And that was actually not how Vietnamese saw the conflict, and that both of the rival states were out to destroy each other and unify Vietnam under their own exclusive rule. Was something that could not really be discussed in Western discourses.
And if I may move the discussion over to the diaspora for a little bit, because I
Sure.
think we're running out of time.
We are. Go ahead.
Is that, Christoph, I also want to kind of supplement what you said earlier about the public discourse on this matter. People are still entrenched in the old rhetoric of communist, anti-communist, and all of that. Yes, we see that. But I have talked to Vietnam, to the Vietnamese veteran who were imprisoned by the current government. They're pretty much ready to move on, and not just to move on, but the word of one of them was very telling. I asked, so why didn't you say anything in meetings about this? And he said, well, out of respect for the pain of my comrades, for the lack of better word, my fellow soldiers or fellow prisoners, they are still in pain, and out of respect for their pain, we stay silent, but they should move on. So there is that undercurrent. I still feel that there is a movement away from that, even if we don't see it on the surface, it
Yeah,
is
no,
there.
no, and I thank you for bringing that up. You know, as I said, I mean, I do empathize, of course, with people who faced these kind of catastrophic events in their lives. They lost their country, their home. They had to flee. And they had to make a new life of themselves in a very different country, and the trauma is living on. And I'm saying this because my father-in-law. Who is Taiwanese? He was actually in a anti-communist re-education camp in Taiwan in the 1950s for 5 years. So these kind of these so-called re-education camps were actually not just a communist thing. That was also the anti-communists did the very same thing in the Cold War and maybe earlier than the Vietnamese, certainly earlier than the Vietnamese communists did that. And you know, my father-in-law was also traumatized for the rest of his life. So you know, these kind of deeply felt, deeply personally felt events. You know, it's asking too much to ask people to step aside and see it from a kind of a wider perspective. But that said, you know, I do want to acknowledge that. But that said, I also want to say that I think, you know, I teach quite a number of Vietnamese American students, and I can see that in the younger generation, I think there's a much more openness now to reach out to Vietnam, to experience the country of their ancestry, and to start gingerly, at least, asking questions. Right, and that brings me back to kind of my own German background. You know, I think one of the largest unanswered questions, particularly in the diaspora, but in general, is how did 30 April 1975 come about? Right, without just simply resorting to the old grievance explanations of the Americans abandoned us, Congress didn't didn't appropriate enough funds, and all of these kind of externalizing reasons. But to really a sober look at what made the Republic of Vietnam collapse in one of the most rapid collapses of any organized state in the 20th century. There must be internal reasons. So far, I don't really see those being honestly addressed. Right? There's a lot of kind of traipsing around, so to say, gingerly around this question. But the catastrophe of 30 April 1975 is so rapid, exposed the Republic as, in many ways, a hollowed out state, that this needs a much more sober analysis in the long run. I think the younger generation might be the one to put this on the agenda.
Well, thanks, Christoph. We're probably going to have to leave it at that for now, although we could probably do another program if you'd like going on from there. So this is Mike Diedrich, KODX 96.9 FM with my guest, Wang Dilhien and Christoph Diebel. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you,
Good to
Mike.
talk to you, Mike, and Ian too, of
Sure.
course.